The views expressed in this podcast are solely those of the speaker. This podcast is for informational purposes only and is not a substitute for professional medical advice from your own physician.
All right, good day to our listeners. Today is March 13th, 2024. My name is Kaku Barka. I'm a member of the Public Outreach Committee of the North American Spine Society. I'm an orthopedic spine surgeon practicing in Houston, Texas. I'd like to welcome everyone to the next installment of our podcast series showcasing interesting articles from Spineline, NASS's membership magazine. They will be discussing the article by Drs. Pedro and Fellings and their team titled "The Shifting Demographics of Spinal Cord Injury: Important Implications for Medicine and Society," published in the January-February 2024 issue. You will have the pleasure of hearing directly from the authors, and our hope and goal is that this discussion will further expound on their compelling article published in Spineline. Just a quick reminder that Spineline is now digital only with a fresh and exciting new format. To read this article and any future issues, go to spinelinemag.spine.org. So gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. Really excited for the conversation. My first question, after reading the article, just thought back to my training and back in my training, I'm not that old, but back in my day, as they say, spinal cord injury was typically an injury that you would see in younger patients due to motor vehicle accidents or higher energy trauma. How is that shifting?
Yeah, so maybe I'll comment on that first and then ask Dr. Pedro to provide some reflections as well. But, you know, we've had remarkable prevention efforts in North America, Europe, communities in East Asia, Australia, and so on, that have dramatically impacted on injuries occurring due to car accidents, workplace injuries, diving-related injuries, and so on. These still occur, but the incidence is much less. And initially, when I was starting in practice, I had envisioned that perhaps one day spinal cord injury would become a rare event. Remarkably, what's been occurring is that the incidence and prevalence of spinal cord injury has not decreased, and if anything, it's creeping up. And what's occurred is that because of the shifting demographics in our society, where we're seeing an aging population, but people who have traditionally been referred to as old, let's say people in their 60s and 70s, for example, are much healthier than in the past, and they're doing sports and other types of activities. And so falls in older individuals, middle-aged people, is now the predominant mechanism. And what we're also seeing is the impact of undiagnosed degenerative cervical myelopathy. And individuals may not be aware that they have imbalance in their walking. They may be a titch clumsy. And if there's significant cervical spondylosis with cervical cord compression, then someone has a fall mechanism that can lead to a spinal cord injury. And in fact, the commonest phenotype of spinal cord injury now in our society is a cervical injury, an incomplete injury due to a central cord mechanism with usually low velocity types of falls. And many spinal cord injuries are now being taken care of, not in level one trauma units at university centers, but in fact, in the community. And so this has been a major shift in the demographics. And maybe I'll ask Dr. Pedro to also, comment in terms of, his own reflections.
Yes, for sure, Dr. Fellings. So as Dr. Fellings has mentioned, we are currently in the midst of a demographic shift. And I think this is not only true for developed countries, but also in developing countries where the elderly population is what Dr. Fellings has been referring to, especially the age group of 65 and above, is now currently what is considered the fastest growing segment of the population. So what we've been seeing is that, I've been traditionally thought that, the demographics of spinal cord injuries, a bimodal peak, you have one at the young age and an older age. But I think now as Dr. Failings alluded to, we're seeing more shift towards more of the elderly population as a result of this of this population shift. So lots of issues to tackle, especially in this older age group, and some issues that pertain especially to spine surgery, and changing the demographics and the way we manage these patients. So.
No, that's very interesting, and I think if I heard correctly, this is not a localized problem. This is a global problem, right? That demographic shift is happening globally. Is that correct?
Yeah. Indeed it is. And a few years ago, my team and I authored an article that was published in one of the Lancet publications, where we commented on the important prevalence worldwide of neurotrauma, so both traumatic brain and spinal cord injury, but the surprising rise in the incidence of spinal cord injury, despite quite effective prevention efforts. And this is a reflection of the shifting demographics that are occurring and the shifts in the injury mechanisms. And undiagnosed cervical myelopathy is an important contributing factor to this as well.
That's a very interesting. Next question for you guys. So in the article, it talks about not only this demographic change, but I think it also mentioned that there's a difference in the rate and cause of mortality amongst these patients. We'll classify them as geriatric spinal cord injuries, but this older population. Dr. Pedro, I'll have you take this one. Can you speak to that, about the differences in causes of mortality in this population?
Yes, for sure. So, well, historically, if you look at the early reports of spinal cord injury has been uniformly a devastating condition. But as we improve in terms of knowledge in critical care, medicine, and surgery, there's been a significant shift in improvement of survivorship of these patients. But what we've seen in the literature that we reviewed, even between the young and the elderly age group, there's still a difference in terms of mortality. For one, the most common complication among SCI patients, which is a pulmonary complication, is more devastating in the elderly patients, for sure. So in terms of the the morbidity and mortality profile, there's really a big difference in this population. It goes with the biology, but as well as the frailty in these patients, which is an important emerging concept that has taken over the concept of age. And I think this is more reflective of their condition rather than basing the diagnosis based on outcomes based on age.
That makes sense. And so to go along with it, they always go hand in hand in conferences, right? You got to talk, if you talk mortality, you have to talk morbidity. I think you started leaning on that a little bit when you talked about the differences with the pulmonary complications versus kind of the classic population, that younger population. Are there other factors that you have to think about when you consider the morbidity of this geriatric spinal cord injury population?
Perhaps I'll, jump in here. So I think, the number of important factors. So one is that as an individual ages, it's more likely that they will have concomitant medical conditions. So cardiac issues, hypertension. Many individuals over the age of 70 will be on anticoagulants, such as a factor 10A inhibitor. So that definitely has issues which one needs to consider. From another perspective, if individuals as they're aging, if they haven't maintained their fitness, for example, and when individuals sustain a spinal cord injury, even if they have recovery, there may be a greater functional impact on that person than it might be in a younger person. So a younger person might be able to compensate for an incomplete neurologic deficit. An older individual might not be able to. And I think this highlights, A, the importance of early surgical intervention to optimize the outcome when possible, then also a kind of very proactive rehabilitation. But the protocols that are used for such individuals will have to differ. And we're having to learn how to deal with the important nuances of middle-aged and older individuals, both their medical comorbidities, but also differing responses to rehabilitation protocols.
That's a great point. Sorry, Dr. Pedro, go ahead.
Yeah, no, so just in addition, I think we've quoted some statistics also with regards to post-op delirium in patients, in elderly SCI patients. And we've particularly focused on this issue because we found that, you know, mental health issues, post-op delirium can significantly affect the post-op status of this patient. We've quoted studies where, you know, it's shown that post-op delirium has been associated with longer hospital stay, the need for critical care, a cognitive dysfunction, and post-operative functional decline. So I think this one is a unique complication we have to kind of manage. Not only, you know, when we manage this patient, we have to look at the holistic, you know, package of this patient, not only, you know, centered on the spine issues, but we also have to think about the mental health issues, the social issues, where they're going back to their society. So,
yeah, that is such a great point, and Carlo is absolutely correct. So, in fact, one of the commonest complications that we do see is delirium and cognitive issues, and that is definitely more prevalent in older individuals. So that's a great point.
Does the polypharmacy play into that at all with the delirium, or is that kind of separate?
Well, I would say that older individuals are more sensitive to opiates, and I think we're in general in medicine and certainly in spine surgery, I think we've become very aware of the positive and the negative effects of opiates, right? And that these need to be managed. And I would say that is definitely an issue. And in older individuals, and again, as Carlo has indicated, I think old is a bit arbitrary. It's probably medical frailty is probably a better way to think about this. But let's say in an older or frail individual, I think here getting geriatrics involved can be extremely helpful, and you're quite correct that, you know, particularly if patients are coming in on a number of medications, it can be a bit daunting in terms of trying to manage the individual then with an injury and dealing with, you know, the pain issues, etc., that are kind of associated with this. And one needs to be, I think, quite aware of potential interactions of the medications and potentially negative effects that some of these medications might have on the individual's recovery.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, I think, Dr. Felland, your comments bring two thoughts to mind, and I'll say them both so I don't forget them, but we can address them separately. One, you made a great point. I think you guys discussed it in the article as well, talking about frailty versus chronologic age, and I want us to discuss that. But the second, you know, as you were talking about bringing in the geriatrician, and Dr. Pedro, you also mentioned the complexity sometimes of taking these care of these patients. It seems to it'll be a team approach to addressing them. But again, the mechanism of injury is different. So these are lower energy, probably more likely to be in a community hospital. That might pose a challenge as well to not have that multidisciplinary team set up.
Carlo, did you want to have a go at that?
No, go ahead. Go ahead, Dr. Phoenix.
Okay. Look, I mean, I think you've raised a number of important points. So, I mean, medical and surgical practice shifts over time. We need to be responsive to this. And I would say that while spinal cord injury continues to be an issue that we see in level 1 trauma units, many, if not most, of the spinal cord injuries are now incomplete central cord injuries, and many of these patients will be looked after in the community. And so I think it's important for surgeons, for the NASS members, the majority of whom I think are working in the community, to be aware of this. And there are efforts at NASS, for example, the spinal cord injury, a committee to offer courses and educational processes to bring people up to speed. The second point I would say is that, you know, the practice of spine, there's spine surgery and there's spine medicine, if you will, and it's multidisciplinary in nature. In addition to the geriatricians, who are very important, you know, all the other medical specialties, as well as allied health professionals, you know, nurse practitioners, you know, et cetera, the rehabilitation people, you know, physiotherapists and so on. Like it's a multidisciplinary, you know, type of effort. And I think this type of a multidisciplinary team is particularly important when you're dealing, let's say, with an older individual. And if, you know, if they've got other, you know, comorbidities. The topic, I think, that you referred to around medical frailty is a really important topic. And I'm actually going to hand over to Dr. Pedro because he's published some really nice articles in this area as part of his fellowship training.
Yeah, for sure. So, So frailty has now emerged as a more sensitive, say, metric compared to age. And we have several publications out of this topic. And frailty is really a concept we've inherited from geriatric literature, where they found out that, you know, even in clinical practice, right, we see patients who are elderly, but they even have, you know, better outcomes compared to our younger population. So we really cannot kind of put them in one size fits all concept, because some of these patients really have better outcomes compared to others. And so what they found is that if we base our assessment not on age, but really a combination of different metrics, say, for example, comorbidities, you know, we have different frailty scales now. It's more than 14 from our latest literature review. And if you look at basically these frailty scores, it's a combination of laboratory, clinical scores, clinical information, and this has a better outlook in terms of their outcomes rather than basing on their age. So
that's a great point. And then, you know, when you kind of start looking at frailty versus chronologic age, that might influence or impact the treatments that are often offered. And so when we talk about surgical treatments that are offered for these patients, what other considerations should be made?
Yeah, so I've been an advocate of early surgical intervention for spinal cord injury, and we kind of coined the phrase "time is spine," and spinal cord injury is a time critical event. And you know, those issues are not age dependent in terms of the biology, but the challenge is that when you're dealing with an older individual, particularly if there's frailty, if there's medical comorbidities, you have to balance the benefits of surgical intervention and early surgical intervention versus the very real issues of taking care of a person who has got, you know, a number of underlying medical issues and now a spinal cord injury. And so you have to balance this. I would say that with, you know, a severe, let's say, incomplete cervical spinal cord injury, say an ASIA C type of an injury, if an individual is healthy enough to have an anesthetic and have early surgery, that's still the preferred option. Many patients will have a less severe injury, so what we would call an ASIA D injury, where the cord has been injured and patients, you know, say have burning hands, they have some hand dysfunction, a bit of walking issues, but there's an incomplete injury. I think in those individuals, if possible, surgery is still the best management strategy. But in my own practice, I don't necessarily operate on those patients on an emergent basis because I think there the data are not as compelling that operating on an emergent basis, say within the first 24 hours, is that much better than, let's say, delaying that by a few days. And then that allows you to have the opportunity to get a handle on, you know, the other medical conditions, which are, which are important. And again, I think, you know, this highlights the need for an awareness amongst practitioners in terms of how to tailor the treatments and, if you will, to personalize the approach. And it was really from that perspective that's really what inspired us to write this article, because we felt that this was an important issue that would be of relevance to pretty much any spine surgeon who would be taking call, whether they're in community practice or in academic practice.
Yeah. So in addition to that, you know, as I mentioned a while ago, frailty has now taken over the concept of age. And I've seen some treatment-based options that are based on frailties. And so this frailty-based rehabilitation, for example, in patients with a goal of optimizing their conditions prior to surgery. I think this is one sort of new concept that we can look into as a spine society, because this has been shown in many other chronic diseases and surgical specialties to be of help in certain populations. So some frailty-based rehabilitation, post-surgical treatment is an emerging field and should be also taken into consideration.
Those are great points. I coming from the orthopedic background, I see a lot of similarities with hip fractures, right? And so that was a big push at time to fixing a hip fracture to try to mobilize people. And it became so well known that hospitals have created protocols and things around it. And hopefully with the work that you guys have done with this article, get people to start thinking of how do we get into place protocols or ways of thinking about treating these patients and do it expeditiously, you know, and I think that'll really help as this information disseminates to the community to get people to start thinking about how we treat these patients and how we do so effectively.
That's such a great point. And the story with hip fractures, I think, is a great story, because I think this is really now emerged as, you know, a very clear standard of care to repair hip fractures early. I would say, kind of from a neuroscience perspective, we've also seen an evolution in the way strokes are treated as well, with an emphasis on the stroke protocols. And I think now we have an opportunity to develop spinal cord injury protocols that would guide excellence in care, and certainly surgical management is an important principle, and when possible, early surgical intervention is optimal to facilitate the early mobilization of patients, and also to minimize complications. And I guess the other flip side as well of early surgical intervention is that there's growing evidence that it's a cost-effective strategy, because it reduces time in the hospital. And of course, that saves costs and also reduction in the complication profile, you know, as well. So I think your analogy with the management of hip fractures really resonates with me, because I would envision that through multidisciplinary efforts that we can, I think, evolve to develop similar concepts related to spinal cord injury. And I think that the North American Spine Society is a fantastic organization to facilitate these efforts.
Yeah. In addition, Dr. Phoenix, I think that is a very important point, really, to highlight that, you know, one of the reasons why frailty has been developed rather than age is really to take away the subjectivity in terms of decision making when you base it only in age. I know some surgeons would often try to be, you know, in some studies they've shown that some surgeons would be hesitant to offer more invasive surgical options in after an age cutoff of say 80 or 90. You know, but with frailty, it invites us to kind of reconsider that, you know, age is not a reliable metric to base upon our decision making, and we have to look at the patient as holistically as possible, taking into consideration different factors aside from age. So.
I agree. A couple more questions for you, gentlemen, and then we'll wrap up. So we talked about the mechanism of injury shifting and being more fall-based rather than high energy trauma. In the article, you mentioned a couple strategies to prevent falls. Let's discuss those briefly.
Yeah, so yeah. I think that, you know, the prevention of any kind of an injury is the best treatment of that injury. And I think that a key strategy that I think we need to start considering is increased awareness of the diagnosis of degenerative cervical myelopathy and facilitating a greater awareness amongst primary care physicians and also specialists who may be non-surgical, including rehabilitation, physiatry, internal medicine, et cetera, neurology. Because the early diagnosis of cervical myelopathy, if there's gait impairment in function, will prevent a central cord injury. And I think that is kind of a key point to consider. And then the other element of this, I think then just in older individuals, we recognize that as people become more frail, you know, and they lose muscle mass and are less mobile, that they have greater propensity to falls. We see this with hip fractures. We see this with geriatric odontoid fractures. And certainly we see this with spinal cord injuries. And so I think, you know, having, you know, greater awareness of this and looking at, you know, ways to prevent falls in the home and so on, you know, becomes, you know, an important consideration. And you know, Carlo, if you wanted to add anything to those comments.
So, you know, in addition to specific clinical management, I think as we mentioned in our article, I think this is also an invitation for us to kind of revisit our public health policies towards kind of looking at fall prevention strategies. So as we mentioned a while ago, polypharmacy in this population is a very big issue. And I think ways or programs to minimize, revisit the medications of this patient is very important. You know, environmental modification, home modifications, vision checking, gait retrainment, and maintenance of adequate nutrition in these patients are all important aspects in preventing falls, which is now, you know, considered as the main mechanism of these patients. So it takes the cooperation not only spine surgeons, but as Dr. Failings mentioned, also colleagues from primary healthcare, rehab, speech pathologies. Especially when these patients go back to their society, we have to establish system for them to go back to their baseline function.
No, excellent. And I was going to ask for closing thoughts, but that was a pretty great way to wrap it there. Anything else that you guys want to mention before we close? Anything that we missed?
I think we want to both express our appreciation to NASS for allowing us to publish this work in Spineline. We wanted to also just have a shout out to our co-authors on the article as well, Doctors Wilson and Butler, and also to the North American Spine Society Spinal Cord Injury Committee. I think in terms of kind of a closing message, the management of spinal cord injury is becoming an issue that I think is of relevance to all spine surgeons and all practitioners in the area of spine. And I think it's reflective of the shifting demographics with the aging of individuals in our society.
Yeah, so also I want to thank the opportunity for us to write this article and publish it in NASLI. You know, this article really highlights the important concepts we have to adopt in our practice as spine surgeons. I think in closing, one of the things we want to highlight is that to emphasize kind of the care of spine patients is really a community effort. We cannot do it only as spine surgeons, but we really need the help of other specialists, especially in the care of these frail elderly patients.
Absolutely. Well, thank you both, Dr. Pedro, Dr. Failings, for joining me. To all the listeners who tuned in, we thank you for joining us today on our NASS Public Outreach podcast. I'd like to acknowledge the help of our wonderful behind-the-scenes team here at NASS with the staff that makes this podcast possible. I am Kaku Barco, signing off from Houston, Texas. And don't forget, stay spine safe. Thanks, everybody.